Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Red Ice. I'm Henrik. Thank you so much for tuning in today. We have another interview lined up for you. We're going to talk with an activist and a nationalist dissident. Choose the words that you'd like. Over in Germany, we have Sascha Rossmüller with us on the show. He's been spoke with Lana back in, I think it was 2020. We tried to figure out what the date on that was, but it's good to have Sascha back on the show. How are you doing?
Thanks for having me. I'm doing good. A little bit of a winter flu, but I don't know how it's labeled because I didn't test it. It doesn't matter for me what's the cause why my nose is running. And just a little bit of a flu, but I'm fine, and it's a pleasure being here with you.
Very good. Yeah, I've had stuff coming and going as well. I never get tested, by the way. I refuse to get whatever it is. I don't buy any of that stuff. All right, it's good to have you here. So we're going to focus on the situation in Germany, at least primarily in the beginning here of the show, and just kind of break down what's happening. It's so much similar things happening in most of our European countries now, to be honest. The EU, you know, interconnected, so what's happening in one country is overlapping to another. Some cases there's law differences, there's things like this, there's things you can say or not say in certain countries, there's, you know, differences like that. But otherwise, it's going in the same direction, which is basically down the toilet. And it's kind of by design as well. That's one of the points. You sent me a good email to outline that as well, that it's like, with this Israeli-Palestine conflict, all these European nations have gotten involved now, and it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like with Ukraine, I guess, to a certain extent, right? We're expected to give up on everything and just send them all your money, send them our weapons, let's support Ukraine. Now it's the same, but with Israel, essentially. And meanwhile, of course, our countries are just going completely down the tubes, and same thing with Germany. Debt is out of control in Germany. The energy situation is very poor. And one of the reasons for that is because they have this green policy. We're going to make the green transition. So let's decommission nuclear power plants. Let's do away with coal, you know, these kinds of things. And then, of course, boom, Nord Stream happens. And miraculously, we're coming into like a period of almost deindustrialization here, Sascha, as well, which is, I think, by design. How would you describe the situation in Germany right now?
It's definitely a full force of deindustrialization we face here in Germany. However, I think it's important to mention that that already started before the Ukraine-Russian conflict. It even started before this traffic light coalition took over the government with the Green Party in a coalition. However, it accelerated since then. And if we do a look on the economic data, then we see a catastrophic picture, and the prognosis are even as catastrophic, of course. And we spoke that we will talk a little bit about this economic issue, and of course, energy is in former times in industrial nation very very crucial point.
Yeah.
And I have done some research to give the audience a little bit of a data how the reality in Germany is, because if I do a look to the mainstream media, I feel that the overall view of Germany is that of a enormous, stable, and rich, and economic strong country, but far away of that. We are, since years, I try to explain the people here in Germany, and more than this, the people abroad, that we are a giant on feet of clay, and that we are highly indebted, and that our economy is in decline since years. And I found one very interesting data, because one can always focus on this daily news, and then daily statistics are always changing, so you never really know is this a foundation for a long-term prognosis. But what's very interesting, I found, whereas in 1960, 61% of the economic output was back then still based on industrial activity in Germany.
Yeah.
And today, this figure is only around 20%.
Yeah.
And more devastating is that the share of economic output accounted for by productive manufacturing in particular is roughly in Germany where it was, and now listen, where it was in the 1880s.
You're kidding. Holy smokes.
No, yeah, really. That's true.
Yeah.
And I think if you hear this data, we could stop. We won't stop the discussion. But if we insist, we can stop. Everything should be clear.
Yeah, of where it's going. Yeah. The macro trends of like where this is going overall. And of course, there's multiple reasons for this. I mean, some of it is by the design. It's not the same type of people around as back. You know, there's many different reasons, right? And if it's more, you know, nationalistic, then etc. These kinds of things as well. Now it's just, you know, there's so many agendas weaved into this, right? From the green transition, this stuff, which is really, in my view, actually is about deindustrialization. And then, of course, so doing away with the automotive industry, all these other industries that Germany used to have. And as you said, it used to be it was like the heart of Europe, right? Manufacturing, production, doing all these things. It was still, you know, one of the countries that still had that. We have the same pattern, really, in Sweden as well. There were when things are starting to go bad for Volvo and Saab, the government didn't step in, and it's kind of like, you know, these brands don't mean that much today. It's all transnational corporations, but it was anchored to a national identity of sorts. Like Volvo was like, it was Swedish steel made by Swedish people, and it was like, you know, a good car. It worked. Same thing in Germany, really good cars and things like that. And when that's eroded, when that's kind of taken away, stripped away, and we become a nation of what they call paper pushers, right? We're sitting behind desks all the time. We don't make anything anymore. Everything is over in China. I think that demoralizes us overall on some level, don't you think?
Yes, it was the same in Germany, like you described regarding Volvo. If you look at BMW, VW, if you look at former days at Opel,
is Opel around anymore?
The employees. The employees had this corporate identity.
Mm-hmm.
They had some identification with their enterprise they have been working for, or working, not just working for, in those days working with. And today, it's not the same employees due to the demographic exchange. And mostly that's no longer employees at all. And so there is no identity with the corporations, with the enterprises. It's more the newcomers, their identity with the welfare system, but not with any enterprise.
Exactly. No, that's true. Everything is robotics. Excuse me, robotics and automation, right? They're going in this direction type of thing. But migration doesn't stop because of that. Isn't that interesting? With the excuse. And, multiple times we've shown these headlines, but it bears repeating. There's newcomers, there's people that, you know, just are waking up to some of these topics, right? But I can't tell you how many headlines were shown specifically out of Germany, too, of how few of these refugees and migrants have come in that actually have jobs. They just come in and they become welfare dependents. They're living off of the state. And yet we're being told that these are the people that somehow are going to raise our GDP, right? They're going to take care of us later when we're old and stuff. It's all lies. It's just a bunch of lies.
They propagize abortion and then tell us that we need the migrants for our pension system. But the reality is that I'm glad that you mentioned this topic, because just a few days ago, a huge German newspaper called Die Welt was headlining even that in the recent few years that more than 2 million immigrated into Germany, but still the economy is lacking a qualified workforce.
Yeah.
So those who are immigrating into the welfare system won't be helpful for our pension system. And that made me do a look on the statistics. And an interesting data is that we have something that was formerly called Hot Sphere. Now it's called Bürgergeld, citizens' money. It's it's a label of the transfer system where you where it's described the money that you get receive if you don't have if you're not in work. And overall in Germany, more than 62% of all welfare recipients are migrants.
Yep.
And on the top of it, within the age cohort, 15 years to 25 years, this number goes up to more than 71%. And the one who is between aged 15 and 25 here in Germany is not working. He never ever plans to work. He's a welfare system addicted and for sure will do everything but not serve our pension system.
Exactly. And then, of course, you know, idle hands, what's the saying again? It's the devil's, I don't know, something like that. Nothing to do, right? So what do you do? Well, you engage in maybe criminality, even if it's petty criminality, or like we're seeing in Sweden, right? There's a huge now, these gang crime things. You have bombs going off in Sweden. People, you know, being murdered because they live in the wrong house next to some supposed gang member or a family member of a gang member. And we're losing control. They were talking about bringing in the military recently. This is liberal Sweden. This was never on the agenda, ever. This was like, you know, a big no-no. And now it's like, let's turn to the military, see if we can keep the peace and keep the order. The only way they can keep this together seems to be with some kind of like militaristic police state or something like that. That's the only way they can have a multicultural society, at least temporarily. Even that doesn't seem to work.
Yeah, they've used this turmoil, and I think it's not by accident. It's a planned turmoil because they use this turmoil as an argument for more for creating more totalitarian states, more civilians, more repression, getting with the argument of safety and security, trying to get the acceptance for the Orwellian overkill.
Yes, exactly. There was some interesting stats there too. We can show that since we talk about, you know, criminality. Yeah. And well, some of these kids, then they're brought in second generation migrants, maybe third, maybe even fourth at this point, right? You think that you know, we heard at least it was like, well, integration, you know, kind of gets better and better, whatever. I think someone broke down that statistically and they talked about some of the major terrorist attacks in European countries. And it was usually like second or even third generation migrants. In other words, they get more, you know, like displaced, essentially, and feel probably out of place in our society as well, which is bizarre. But check this one out. Here's the crime rates of selected nationalities in Western Europe, and Germany, of course, is listed in the first column right there. It says in Germany, Italy and Spain, suspected rates of Algerian immigrants are 10 times to 17 times higher than the suspected rates of German, Italian, Spanish citizens. I'm surprised they got this statistics out, to be honest. I know that Switzerland's still monitoring it or something like that, but yeah, that's what we're looking at. What are these people doing in our countries?
And that figures are clearly the point why I say I'm sorry for the term, not the fuck interested in the circumstances the asylum demander will find after deportation in his country of origin, because I'm more interested in the safety of my family in the homeland of our ancestors.
Exactly. Yep, that's right. Yeah, and this has been, you know, same thing with the policy in Sweden right there. I brought that up as an example a while ago, but it's just fascinating thing that Sweden is always very, you know, obsessed, I guess. And in some cases, it's a good way. In some cases, it's kind of overkill. But safety, 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 right? Whether there's road safety or, you know, other versions, they have guardrails all over society. But on the roads, right, they had a zero policy for a while. No one should die in traffic. So they rebuilt roads. They had, you know, much more stringent, like, you know, when you get your license, like the rigorous training that you need to go through, the amount of time you need to spend on this and stuff like that. Now, of course, it turns out that a bunch of migrants are failing this and they can't get a driver's license. So what do? They lower the bar, right? And essentially say, no, it's okay. Now we should make it easier, right? They've offered it in their own language, even in some cases. And even then, they fail these tests, right? So yeah, now we're at a situation, Sasha, where like, we are expected to go out and risk our own lives and maybe the lives of our children that's with us in our cars just so that these people can be in our countries, not work, not contribute, but drive on the roads and be a potential hazard to us. This is so absurd.
Yeah, yeah. Because if they stumble over their own feet, then it's neocolonialism.
Oh my gosh!
It's a paradox. We have it's absurd when we face fenced in Christian markets that are not allowed to call it any longer as those, but simultaneously have open borders.
Yes, I remember the Christmas market. That's been there was one attack. Maybe that's like 5 years ago now, or something like that. 5-6 years ago, something like that. It was a big attack, and now I've seen multiple countries, especially the big cities, obviously, right? But still, all over the place, huge, basically roadblocks in front to try to prevent people from driving in and things like that. I saw one clip out of Germany too, where some Muslims had set up some Allahu Akbar. They were seeing, a mic session basically right in front of the Christmas in the square. I forget what town it was in, or something like that. But it's just we're losing our countries, Sasha. It's going down the drain. You know what I mean? It's sad to see this, right?
Yeah.
So what?
It's a terrible situation, and it goes on and on. And today I read that in 2023, there has been 300,000 refugees into Germany. That's the town comparable to Augsburg, for example, mm-hmm. or Karlsruhe. That are two German towns with 300,000 inhabitants. And imagine for these people, it's not only about money for food. It's the healthcare, it's the clothing, it's all the infrastructure they use. As you have to build up every year by year, a town for 300,000 people, and I assume that it's in reality it's large more, because I think it was 2 or 3 weeks ago when the head of the Federal Office for Migration and Refugees in Germany reported that the state and the federal authorities could no longer withstand the wave of migration and are no longer able to register. Yeah, what does that mean? If they are no longer able to register, how can we trust the figures? So for sure, the figures will be much higher than we can read in the newspapers.
Exactly. And of course, now we have the conflict in Gaza, and there's been a number of articles about this, how not only Germany, but Germany has been floated, right, as one of the countries that need to accept these Gaza refugees. Here's a remix that you linked to: Germany preparing to accept large influx of Gaza refugees, leading newspaper reports. And it's like, okay, so they're getting some back-end story on this here. Here was another one. Forget what source this was here. Gaza refugees should go to Germany. Palestinians in Gaza, Germany is preparing to accept refugees from the Gaza Strip. This is back in November 20th. And then you had this op-ed. It was a Wall Street Journal, but Times of Israel reported on this too. Two Israeli lawmakers call on European countries to take in Gaza refugees. And when you sent me your email, you mentioned this, and you were like, instead of advocating a two-state solution based on an Israel within the 1967 borders following numerous UN resolutions, coupled with a reparation program for the Palestinians, the German government is doing the Zionist business by supporting Israel's depopulation of the Gaza Strip by promising to take in the Palestinians. However, Germany, which is now more than 2.3 trillion euros in debt, and we should talk more about that, because that's insane, can no longer afford its bankruptcy policy. Excuse me. This year alone, Germany is allowing itself the dubious luxury of the following expenditures. Let me list these here. 50 billion euros for immigration, 33 billion euros for development aid, whatever that is. Is that money going out of the country, I assume, then altogether?
Out of the country for the third world countries.
Yeah. 21 billion euros for EU contributions, and then 15 billion euros for NGOs. I'd love to see a full list of that. I'm not sure if there's a breakdown of that, but that is just insane. And this is the same in every country. It's just, they're printing money, they're just flinging it away. It's like it's like they know that the party is over, and they're just trying to get as much of it, squeeze as much out of it as they can at the end. What's happening? Who is this by design? Who's doing this?
And on top of it, just recently, the Supreme Court, the Constitutional Court in Germany, ruled that the budgets, the national budget, have been unconstitutional because they made some special assets that have not been budgeted within the original budget that should be transparent, a kind of shadow households. Mm-hmm. And those shadow households grew much higher than the original national budget. That's absolutely insane. But it was one day after the Supreme Court ruled that, hey guys, that's unconstitutional, you can't work this way. By the way, they are working with money they don't have.
Exactly.
But one day after, the fiscal committee of the parliament met together, and they decided on more expenditures. One day after this constitution, and they said, okay, we have such a thing called a debt break, where a debt is limited in relation to the GDP in Germany.
Yeah.
But there is an exemption if in emergency case. And so they said, okay, then we will call out an emergency, presumably it will be the climate emergency, and then we don't have to abide to this limit. Yes, of course we have an emergency in Germany, but the only and the main emergency is sitting on the benches of the government.
Yeah,
but
I know.
Not what they hallucinate in environmental things for their fiscal policy.
It's like they have everyone under control throughout the entire government. You know what I mean? Is there any voice? Is there any like critical voice? I'm not sure if you watch any of the day to day activities as such by some of these politicians or whatnot. But like, what? Maybe there's some like AfD. Wasn't that one of the reasons, by the way, why some of the AfD were actually doing very well? They were sensible on the energy question, I believe, which is like why so many Germans were like, okay, well that's at least reasonable. We have to get heat our homes somehow. And then, of course, it's the migration issue overall that they addressed there. But is there anyone calling this out, like in the German parliament or any of these politicians, as far as you know?
Yeah, the problem is that the center party, the CDU, the center party tries to convince the Chancellor Scholz to break with the Greens, to break with this coalition, and they want back in a great coalition, the center with the Social Democrats. And so the CDU did before the Supreme Court to put the pressure high, launched this legal infringement, this legal proceeding in that regard. But however, if due to the fact that they want also into the government, so they then. They're not really won't make this paradigm shift in fiscal policy that would be required now.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's still reparations, obviously, that Germany pays to Israel. I was trying to find a number for that, too. And apparently that's going to, end in, 2045? We'll see what happens. But let me see, is this just... this is one screenshot. This is not current, right? But... it says here, West Germany paid Israel a sum of 3 billion marks, around 714 million United States dollars, according to a 1953-1955 convention rate over the next 14 years. 450 million marks were paid to the World Jewish Congress. And that's just one screenshot. I think I had others somewhere of them showing just kind of the year after year, expenditures on this issue as well. I don't know how these systems just continue to go on. Here it is. Let me show you this real quick. Just that could be interesting for the audience to see that, too. Here we go. From 1945 to 2018, it says down there, the German government paid approximately 86.8 billion, that's the United States dollar there, in restitution and compensation to Holocaust victims and their heirs. And I'm not sure if that's maybe also on the side of, in addition to maybe what Germany gives to Israel, overall, there's aid, as you said, in the other included, right? The 33 billion euros for development aid. I'm sure some of that might go to Israel as well. But it's just this, most European nations are like this. You look at it, right? The EU overall just gives Africa like 20 billion euros every year or something like crazy like that. I just, how long can this go on, do you think, to be honest?
A record number, because you mentioned development aid. A record number was in 2020 when Germany, alone Germany, not the EU, just Germany gave more than 41 billion euros foreign aid to Africa.
And again,
we don't have this. We don't have this money. We are indebted with 2.3 trillion euros. It's absolutely crazy, and I'm sure that's for design. And yes, it would be a topic for itself to discuss with this Africa and foreign aid, and then also in regard of this migration, because it's very interesting, and I don't think that a lot of people are not aware that how the population explosion is going on the African continent,
yeah,
and how the relation of those figures is to the overall inhabitants in the European Union. And by 2050, it's not very long, 2050, for example, Niger alone could be home to as many people as the entire EU,
yep, I know,
inhabits.
Yep.
And but what most people don't know is, because the proportions, if you're looking on the map, the proportions, if you're looking on the globe or are looking on a map, are not mirrored how they are in reality are. Because Africa will, even if they have this population growth, which you never can solve with asylum politics.
No.
Lunatic who thinks this should go back to the school benches for mathematics, he hasn't grasped what's an exponential function.
Yeah.
But Africa will by no means be too cramped, as the continent is around 10 times larger than India, which is currently home to a population of roughly the same as Africa is.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. And then, of course,
the continent is so large that it could accommodate the USA and China.
Yeah.
And if you do a look to the population density in Africa, it's less than 50. I don't know per square kilometer. Mm-hmm. I don't know how the population density per square kilometer is in the USA, but in Europe it is 117,
yeah,
and in Asia it's 150, but in Africa it's 50. Why should we,
yeah,
Europeans,
I know,
we occidental kind of mankind, we white people, why should we save one who is witnessing a population explosion while we are in decline, only 6% or 7% of the whole global population, in the children only 3%. That's absolutely absurd, and also in economic terms it's not necessary, because 60% of the world's arable land are in Africa. A third of all unused agricultural land is in Africa, and that's according to UN figures. Around 30% of the world's mineral deposits, guess where? In Africa.
Yep.
12% of the world's oil reserves, Africa. 8% of the world's natural gas reserves, in Africa located. So there is no need that we transport Africa to Europe, because it won't help Africa. However, in Europe nothing will be left that deserves this name any longer.
Yeah, there was someone looking
for that suppression now, but it broke out of me.
No, that's good. It's very interesting, and it's true, because I focus on that too. And you have this thing, well, you know, you came and stole all this and blah blah blah, but it's like, look at the amount of money, like, that we're helping and trying to get. And look, I get that there's corruption down there. There's some warlords that you know, arise, and then there's some civil war. There's conflict, blah blah blah. I'm not saying there's no, you know, maybe meddling or whatever. But you have corrupt interests, and they sell weapons to the right side, you know, this side, and then they go to war with the other. I get all that stuff, right? But we've had that kind of stuff in Europe too. That's part of our history too. We had those things happening, but now it's like this. You know, we're expected to have this kind of hands-off approach while we've been giving them billions, right? Let me do a couple of screenshots here. Here's from the African EU Partnership website, on the EU, right? And let me zoom in on that portion up there. It says the EU and its member states are the biggest donor to the African continent, approximately 20, as I said before, 20 billion euros a year in development aid is directed to Africa. What's happening with this money? Where is it going? Like, there was a YouTuber, what's his name, Mr. Beast, that went down recently and like building wells, drilling for water, you know, wells and stuff like that. It's like, why does an American white kid have to show up and drill wells in Africa when like this amount of money is it's sad, right? And here's another one, by the way, a game of give and take, a classic screenshot. Yeah. They talk about the rise of the global south and all that stuff. Well, guess who's been paying for this? It's Western, you know, countries, the northern parts of it, with the addition of like New Zealand and Australia down in the south, essentially. Japan, you know, is one of the countries part of that too, I guess. And in the U.S., one of the tweets here from Battlebeak said the total aid to Africa from 1960 to 2013 comes up to over $5 trillion, or the equivalent of about 50 Marshall Plans. Germany was given I'm not debating whether it was good or not, whatever. America, you know, has occupied Germany since then. It is official on the books even, right? But they got, I believe, one Marshall Plan, and then it was the extension, the German Marshall Fund, the follow-up were called, or something like that, right? But yeah, it's not even comparable. And so obviously, this amount of money is helping also to grow the populations, not fix many things maybe with the corruption, and then instead, Sasha, they're pouring into Europe and America and some of the other countries as well, while their population at home, as I said, continues to grow, and with the low density, they will be able to presumably continue to grow as well. Unsustainable. This just doesn't work, right?
Yeah, never ever.
I'm not sure what to do about it, but I think it's hands-off approach or something. They got to solve their own issue. We have our own problems now. You know what I mean? The point is, we can't carry the rest of the world on our backs, right?
There are a lot of African economists who are very critical to this kind of foreign aid, because they say that the result of this pouring money is that you learn the people just waiting to receiving the aid.
Exactly. So they, yeah.
To never become productive in their own way, in their own cultural and in their own traditional way, in their own traditions they had made with their cattles or with their agriculture or whatever.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of economists from Africa who say if it would be better for the continent and they would be more successful if we would at least not help this way as we do now.
Now it's like, what is it called, the UN World Food Program or something, that they either drop bags of rice and milk powder or something, you know what I mean? Like, you just end less stuff like that has been happening. And as you say, I mean, you gotta, what's the old saying, right? You gotta teach a man to fish, not just give him the fish, right? Anyway, it's a huge issue, just that's compounding on top of what's already happening. The question is, though, as things change, presumably financially, I mean, unless they whip out an ace card, or what do you call it, an ace through their sleeve, as the saying goes, and let's say overhaul the economic system, or they make a digital, you know, euro, they go for some kind of central bank digital currency or something like this, and they kind of decide to write off the debt or like scrap the old system and then just kind of keep going, maybe they will do something like that. To keep, you know, everything going, which I guess would be that would be very bad. Actually, it's probably better to just have a heavy recession, have a crash, have a fall, have a collapse, and so, you know, build it back up again or something like that. But if the welfare stops coming, right? If we can't even take care of ourselves, obviously we're not going to be able to take care of all these other people as well. Could that help us, a bad economic situation? Could that help us in terms of like restoring some of the demographics to our countries? What do you think?
I think it will help in an ethical and morally sense, because in hard times you have to concentrate more on the really essential things. In hard times you're not interested in tittytainment, or in hard times it's the top point on the agenda will not be the transgender toilet or anything else. And if there I think they will do this over expansion and this digitalization and everything, but this over expansion will be more and more harder to control. And if it will collapse, then it will be a fragmentation of systems, of institution. But this out of this fragmented institutions, maybe there will be a rise from fragmentation to regionalization. And that could be maybe a healthy development, but the problem is that I fear that mankind will learn it the hard way and not by reason.
Yeah, that's true. And it's always when we get too comfortable, right? We get super complacent in that, and at some point we have to kind of be pushed back into reality a little bit, in touch with nature and how things used to be. It seems to be a natural cycle, and we're just kind of at the top of that right now. We're about to find out just, you know, how much we've been living above our means, and you know, again, unless they wheel something out, because I am worried about that. I mean, I think one of the things you're probably, you know, aware of that too, right? The central bank digital currency plans, they're floating this in the EU right now. Christine Lagarde recently of the European Central Bank mentioned that they're trying to take the euro digital. And then on top of that, the IMF are working on kind of like a global central bank digital currency. Individual nations are doing that as well. But this money would be what they call programmable, essentially, right? So think of dissidents or those on the outside. Just as an example, look at how the German government have treated the AfD, Alternative for Deutschland, and some of the politicians there. I think it was specifically, I forget which region, was it in Bavaria, Bayern, right? One area where they were doing very, very well, and the government is like, oh, basically they're terrorists. They labeled, what's that what they did? They labeled them right-wing extremists or something, and they're under surveillance, some of the politicians now, right?
Yeah, in the eastern part of Germany, or in the part of the former German Democratic Republic, they're in the polls, they're leading the polls. If it be it in Saxonia, be it in Thuringia, be it in Brandenburg, they are leading the polls, and in next year there will be federal elections, but we will see that in some or in several of that federal states of Germany, the AfD will win the election, but there is no hope that they will be in the government coalition.
Right.
And I hope that then people will realize that democracy has said his goodbye.
Yeah, come to its conclusion. That's that, right? Because if this is what people are voting for, and the government steps in, whoa, 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 easy there now. You can't vote for whatever party you want.
Yeah, and maybe that's an eye opener also again for people. Maybe that will accelerate some developments, and maybe that will also bring some AfD politicians to more realistic mindset, not only this coalition pipe dreams. And maybe in some of that states there are also interesting developments, not only the party I belong, Die Heimat, but also there are some regional developments. For example, in Saxonia, there are the so-called the Free Saxonians, translated Freie Sachsen, and they are on the local level. They are also in some municipalities, and they are really successful, and they are the leading force on the protests on the street. And I can imagine, and I will run the election next year in Saxonia, I can imagine that we will see next year in Saxonia, next to the AfD, another right-wing group in the parliament with those Free Saxonians. And that can be a pretty interesting development. And I'm glad about this development, because we also need forces that the voters can take as a kind of a litmus test if the just conservative rights will deliver what the voter has ordered.
Yeah, in Sweden you've had that too, right? As kind of obviously the population overall is drifting more towards nationalistic policies, and they want their country back. Essentially, progressively, parties that used to be, like they say, the moderate party, which is used to be our conservatives or whatever, they pick up talking points, be that from the Sweden Democrats, and then you have Alternative for Sweden, you kind of pushing a little bit on the Sweden Democrats and nudging everybody a little bit in that direction. But the dangers, of course, they pick up the talking point. The rhetoric is there, and they say, "Oh, we got to do this, got to do blah blah blah," but nothing happens. You know what I mean?
Never implementing anything. Yeah.
Yeah. And it just delays the entire process, and then people are like, even Sweden Democrats, like, I'd love to give them a chance. Same thing with AFD. Like, if they could, sure, go ahead. Do it. But look at like Meloni, right, in Italy, the phony Meloni, baloney, as we call her now.
Huge disappointment,
right? All these talking points initially, and do this and do that, and then she comes in, and then it's worse under her. And I think a lot of Italians are like, finally, great, okay, we didn't get Salvini, but we have her at least, right? She's going to fix things for us now, and then nothing happens, and you have this long delay of, like, well, however long they're in there. Italy's a little bit different. It's kind of more chaotic, their political system, but, like, say she's in there for 4 years or whatever. Now you have a four-year delay where migration continues, it just gets progressively worse, and more damage is inflicted until... And I'm not saying that the solution to all of our problems here is political, but it's part of it, obviously. We have to operate and work on that level as well. But it just delays it, and it just makes it worse, right?
Yes. The conservative right formations, that's not only in Germany. I think that's overall in Europe, be it in Germany, be it in Sweden, or wherever. The conservative right formations often... relatively young organizations without a long tradition, moreover with often a composition of dissatisfied people looking for a new direction, who often came from very political camps previous. And so they often lack guanatura, they lack the unity and needed rigor, and also a lack of resilience to repression leads to some demarcations at the behest of their actual political opponents, not cooperate with one who is labeled more far right, but the one who does the labeling is the political enemy. History never rewarded one who did an ideological retreat on behalf of the enemy. And however, on the other side, by being widely recognized in the public due to the successes, they can make, there's a possibility to make a valuable contribution to preventing the area of what can be said from being further restricted, or even contribute to expand that. And their successes are valuable for initiating a change in political awareness and politicizing new circles who previously have not been with political awareness and consciousness. However, voters' expectations must not be disappointed. And so far, protest voters, the name it says, have mostly not been delivered what they ordered.
No.
Solid, audible protest. And this is why traditional, genuinely ethno-nationalist formations are important as a kind of litmus test for voters to visibly ensure the extent to which populist organizations deliver. And moreover, the right-wing conservatives mostly do little work on the meta and the pre-political field.
Exactly. No, they're there to trim the branches a little bit, and they don't strike at the roots of these problems, right? And you do have something I'll ask you more about that in part two. We're going to take a break here in a little bit. But just there's another, at least what I'm seeing, level of maybe not activism is the right. There is that too. There's plenty of groups out there, a lot of protests and things like that too. And that's good as well. But just a lot of younger guys in many European countries, it's happening in the US, it's happening in Australia, things like that. They're just. they're getting together, they're forming groups, they're training together, they're just getting together, forming their little, you know, tribe, essentially, right? And that's something that's very good as well. That's something we have to turn to, and I want to ask you more about that later on. I also want to talk about the kind of the media environment a little bit, because you mentioned that, like, just that continuous pressure of just, like, let's just call them, you know, far right and bigots and, you know, whatever it is, and that will keep them in line. And for some, that works. For, you know, it's just about delaying, how do I put it? It's to get us to bow down to them for as long as possible so that they can inflict as much damage as possible on our countries. That's what it feels like, right? So, and I also want to ask you about the Nord Stream attack, because we didn't really get into that, but just like, what's the view on that in Germany and stuff? Because that's one of the hardest hit countries regarding that, right? But let's do a couple of plugs here. We're going to wrap up the first segment in a little bit, but I want to do a couple of plugs. I know you have two books in the works that I'm not sure if you've written them now, or are they just being translated now, Sasha, the two books you mentioned?
I have written already two books. One of the two books is also available in English language, one only available in the German language. One book is... The one which is in English language available is Europe contra EU, Let's Break Away from Brussels. That's available in German and English language. And the other is a book about geopolitics. It's unfortunately only in German language available. It's translated. The title would be Geopolitical Sea Change, Multipolarity instead of Imperialism. But you're right. I'm currently working on two different books. I hope to finish in 2024. One book should be a more extensive volume, not only focused on this daily politics, but more on this, on the cultural, political, philosophical, ideological roots. The book, and another one, it will be a little bit a shorter volume that maybe I can finish within the next 3 months or so, I hope. That will be a book about culture, and it will be a little bit also a book, a very personal book, because I will try to explain, I will introduce my favorites in culture on the different fields, mm-hmm. and why that are my favorites. And I try to do it in a kind of way that young nationalists maybe can take this as a first step to get acquainted with our Occidental traditional culture, be it in literature, be it in philosophy, be it in painting, be it in music. And the reader will become introduced my personal favorites with a description why they are my favorites, why I love them, and why I think they are important for our European political work.
Yeah, something we need to be reminded of, all the time. To be honest. Why do we do what we do? What are we trying to preserve? You know, all those things. We got to remember all that. We got to talk about our culture, our heritage, our traditions, you know, those kinds of things. Very, very important. Now, at the moment, I actually have some issue to load some of the websites for some reason, but let's see if I can add them in post. Deutsche, it's a minor trick, it's a hyphen in English, stimme.de, that's, of course, you know, in German language. And then Die Heimat, it's formerly the NPD. Do you want to say anything about the party that you're involved in there?
Yes, Die Heimat, it made a reform process, this party. It was known in the right-wing circles as National Democratic Party of Germany, the NPD. And the leadership of NPD was working 3 or 4 years to adapt to new situations. Because of populist new successful formations, we have been a little bit marginalized in the parliamentarian and party political way, despite we had some on the local level, some parliamentarians, but not on the federal and the nationwide level anymore. And we thought we have to go to adapt to a new situation. And we wanted to combine this with a new nomenclatura. And we saw that we had some resources in our party. We have been marginalized. But on the other hand, we had some houses. We have a good circle of skilled lawyers with experience on this particular field. We have a very high quality magazine. I also had an interview years ago with Lana, an excellent interview in that it's also called Deutsche Stimme, that magazine. And we have a publishing company with this and a lot of such resources, but we couldn't use this and optimize this potential anymore. And so we thought we have to change our bylaws, our statutes, not the ideology, not the program, but our bylaws to be more an anti-party or more than a party and not any longer work in organizational egoism in competition, but to offer more, to use also our resources in cooperation, and that we had also on the top made this reform with this new nomenclatura, and so this party no longer is named NPD, but it's the Heimat. I don't know how to translate the homeland, the homestead, the homeland,
right. Yep.
Or anything like that.
Yeah.
And I'll be running next year for the European election.
Okay. All right. There you go. Yeah. Okay. Very, very good. Interesting. Yeah. And then you mentioned, of course, Deutsche Stimme as well, the magazine, right? Tell us about that.
Yes. It's it was a newspaper for many, many years. And then in 2020 I think it was back 2020, we started to make it more in a high profile magazine with more professional quality. And unfortunately, it's only in German language. But if one do a look in the homepage, we can see how professionally this is made. It has the same quality as the Focus or Spiegel or the mainstream magazines have in kind of this of the makeshift the professionality.
Definitely. We'll have some links to this down below as well. We got that. And then, a couple of, I guess, some of the personal places where people can follow you. Do you have a Telegram channel, Ross Mueller's Dissident channel? It's simply...
Yes, this is the one in English language.
Yep.
I also, of course, have a one in German language that is fine for the German speaking audience of Red Eyes. They find me under my name, Sascha Rossmüller, also a German channel with more followers and where I more often, of course, post in the German. But I regularly inform also in this English channel, Rossmüller's Dissident channel, nearly on a daily basis or several times a week at least. And I'm also on Gab, which I post mostly in there are some you see it's pinned there is in German, but mostly in Gab is posted in English mm-hmm. language by me, and I've also on Getter where I post bilingual German and English, and after not so much followers because after Elon Musk took over. I made my Twitter, now X, account, and I also post sometimes German, sometimes in English language. So if someone want to find me, it's easy to find me, and I'm thankful and for everyone who follows me and most of all, not just follows me, but distributes the information, the data.
Exactly.
There.
Yep, that's it. Yeah, awesome. So we'll have some of these links down below, of course, as well. Let's see if I can get the Heimat and Deutsche Stimme. It doesn't load on my end, so I'm thinking, like, some VPN block or something. I'll see if I can figure it out later. But anyway, I'll add links to those below, guys, so definitely check that out and then follow, Sascha on some of the social media that we mentioned here as well. So we're going to take you... Oh, and we got to mention, too, by the way, let's mention, where's the website? Here we go. Europa Terra Nostra as well, of course. You're what's your position there again? You're vice?
I'm vice chairman of Dan Ericsson, a friend of you I know since many years from Sweden.
Yeah, they're doing great work.
Vice chairman of Europa Terra Nostra, and there are also to find some articles I've written in, of course, in English language. And I've been also in Sweden a few years ago. I've been in Sweden at the Svenska Arnahus in Oskarot at an event of Dan Erickson, and it was very impressing.
They have a great facility there and stuff like that. They're building that. It's really, we could talk more about that, of course, in the second one. Take a break in a moment. But yeah, that's part of what the activism is that I'm talking about. People are just doing it. They're just getting together. They're forming community. They're forming tribes, these kinds of things. That's really what it is all about. All right, more coming up, guys, in the second part together with Sasha Rosmuller. Stay with us, everybody. We'll be right back. Join us for part two with Sasha Rosmuller as we continue to discuss Israel and the future of their country and where that's going. What happens if Israel loses? What happens if Palestine or Palestinians, or at least the Gaza Strip, if they lose in the West Bank? Two different scenarios. What's the optimal one for us as Europeans? We'll talk more about that. We'll talk overall about how the media is losing kind of the narrative, and them as regime enforcers is just kind of discrediting them more and more and more. We talk about the polarization, really, that comes in the wake of the media and politicians doing what they have done and continuing to do in our countries. We also talk more about the destruction of the Nord Stream, kind of how that was viewed both in Germany, but also by Sasha himself. Really huge attack. And so you're seeing this massive, shift, not only in the energy sector, but in the geopolitical, on the geopolitical chessboard as well, as a consequence, right? You have all these different NATO countries now, such as Turkey being a thorn in the side of other NATO countries. Then at the same time, you have the rise of the BRICS countries and what they call the multipolar world order. What does that mean for us? Is that any good? We'll discuss that. And then also we'll talk towards the end more about kind of generally just that type of activism and community building and tribe forming and training that we're seeing all throughout European society. A lot more people are getting together. They're just doing things themselves as things centralize more and more, as power centralizes. And we drift, be that planned, of course, towards world government. They're kind of losing that granular control, maybe? I don't know. I mean, they are targeting groups, and we'll talk more about that, too. In Germany, the Artgemeinschaft was recently banned. What was that about, right? So they target groups, and they outlaw groups, and they try to shut them down. But they can't shut down all of us. And that is something that's growing, and it's a positive direction for where we're going. People are networking more than before. They're looking for solutions among their own as opposed to among politicians, which, of course, is never ultimately how any of this will be resolved, to be honest. We'll talk more about that. So it's a great part two coming up together with Sasha Rosmuller. So join us at redhousemembers.com for a membership. Please support us. Keep in mind, we don't have any huge sponsors. Also, we don't interrupt with annoying ads. We don't try to push gold or VPNs on you in the middle of our shows. So if you like what we do, please support us with a membership. It's really the best way to do it. It's only $10 a month, but if you get a longer one, you get it cheaper. You get almost 35% off if you get a 2-year subscription. So you can do it that way as well. So as we said, you can do it on redhousemembers.com. We have some embedded options there, like DonorBox, but there's a number of other methods. We're working on a more permanent payment processor here coming up next as well. Otherwise, there's other methods for you. You can join on Odyssey, you can join on Subscribestar, or our Locals, our recent addition. We're adding new members' content on our Locals, redeyestv.locals.com. So that's some of the options. Please support us with a membership. We're only here because of you, so thank you so much for being there for us so that we can be there for you. All right, guys, also want to say thanks to our executive producers today. T. Lothrop Stoddard, V. Miller, Resin Revolt, Good Luck Lap, Jake, Red Pill Rundown, French 47, Mark Smith, No One Jeeves, President Obunga, Mongoose, William Fox, Angry White Soccer Mom, The Second Wanderer, Operation Werewolf, The Ride Never Ends, Francis Parker Yockey, Dillabob, Last Place Simp, Joseph Hart, Purple Haze. We also have Colin Marriott, Call Me Combo Deal, The Dearborn Toxic Event, Brendan Anthony, and 55 Club Books. Also thanks to our producers, Mr. Walker, 696, Johansson, Leroy Dumont, Snark Pup, Eyes Open, Mr. Lemry, Urinu, Obadiah Hakeswell, Perfect Brute, Single Action Army, HP Lovecraft, Dixie Drone Force, and 55clubbooks.com. Thank you so much, guys. We appreciate your support. If you want to get an executive producer tier or a producer tier, you can get that at redhatmembers.com. You can get it on Odyssey or Subscribestar. Definitely check that out. Get some resources our way if you want to. You can also, of course, donate to the show. That's a great way of helping us out as well. redhats.tv/donate if you feel so inclined. We appreciate all your support. Thank you so much, everybody. We'll be right back with part two together with Sasha Rossmuller. We'll see you on the other side.